Coates pulled his truncheon. It was, Vimes saw, custom-made, slightly longer than the general issue. He took up station in front of the constable, with his back very expressively towards Vimes. "What do you want me to do, Sarge?" he said over his shoulder. "Show him a few decent moves, take him by surprise." "Right you are, Sarge." Vimes watched the desultory clatter of sticks. One, two, three, and around Ned came, truncheon whistling through the air, but Vimes ducked under the blow and caught the man's arm in both hands, twisting it up behind his back and bringing his ear into immediate conjunction with Vimes's mouth. "Not quite unexpected, sunshine," he whispered. "Now, we'll both keep grinning because the lads are laughing at our Ned. Isn't he a card who keeps having a go at the old Sarge, and we don't want to spoil their fun? I'm letting you go now, but you try it on one more time, and you'll have to use both hands to pick up a spoon. And you'll need to pick up a spoon, Ned, because of living off soup, by reason of having no damned teeth." He relaxed his grip. "Who taught you this stuff, anyway?" "Sergeant Keel, Sarge," said Ned.
"You're doing a good job, Sergeant Keel."
Vimes turned to see Captain Swing advancing across the yard. He was smaller and slimmer in daylight, and he looked like a clerk, and a clerk who was only erratically careful about his appearance. His hair was lank, and the thick black strands plastered across a central bald spot suggested that the man had either no mirror or completely lacked a sense of humour. His coat, in the light, was old-fashioned but well cared for, but his buckled shoes were scuffed and generally downtrodden. Vimes's mother would have had something to say about that. "A man ought to look after his boots," she always said. "You could tell a man by the shine of his shoes." Swing also carried a walking stick, or rather an opera cane. It was just possible that he thought it made him look sophisticated, rather than, say, like a man carrying an unnecessary length of wood. It was certainly a sword stick, because it rattled when it hit the pavement. And it did so now, as he primly picked his way through the old targets and straw debris.
"Keeping the men up to scratch, I see," he said. "Very well done. Is your captain here?"
"I believe not," said Vimes, letting Coates go.
"Sir." "Ah, well, perhaps you will give him this, Sergeant Keel."
Swing gave him a faint smile.
"You had a successful night, I am given to understand."
"We had a few visitors," said Vimes.
"Sir." "Ah, yes. Misplaced zeal. It does not pay to underestimate you, Sergeant. You are a man of resource. Alas, the other houses were not so resourceful."
"Ah, yes.
I am afraid, Sergeant, that some of my keener men feel you are an obstacle to our very needful work. I, on the contrary, believe that you are a man of iron adherence to the law, and while this has led to elements of friction because of your lack of full understanding of the exigencies of the situation, I know that you are a man after my own heart."
Vimes considered the anatomical choices.
"That would be broadly correct, sir," he said, "although I would not aspire that high." "Capital. I look forward to our future cooperation, Sergeant. Your new captain will undoubtedly inform you of other matters as he sees fit. Good day."
Swing swiveled and walked his jerky walk back to the gate. His men turned to follow him, but one of them, who was wearing a plaster cast on one arm, made a gesture.
"Morning, Henry," said Vimes.
He examined the letter. It was quite thick and had a big embossed seal, but Vimes had spent too much time in the company of bad men and knew exactly what to do with a sealed envelope. He also knew how to listen. New captain. So it was starting. The men were watching him.
"They're calling in more soldiers, Sarge," said Snouty.
"I expect so," said Vimes.
"They gave Captain Tilden the push, didn't they?"
"Yeah."
"He was a good captain,"
Snouty protested.
"Yes,"
Vimes said. No, he thought, he wasn't. He was a decent man, and he did his best, that's all. He's well out of it now.
"What are we going to do now, Sarge?"
said Lance Constable Vimes.
"We'll patrol," said Vimes.
"Close in. Just these few streets."
"What good'll that do?"
"More good than if we didn't, lad. Didn't you take the oath when you joined up?"
"What oath, Sarge?"
"He didn't," Vimes remembered. "A lot of them hadn't. You just got your uniform and your bell, and you were a member of the night watch. A few years ago, Vimes wouldn't have bothered about the oath either. The words were out of date, and the shilling on a string was a joke.
But you needed something more than the wages, even in the night watch. You needed something else to tell you that it wasn't just a job. Snoutley, nip up to the captain's office and get the shilling, will you? Said Vimes. Let's get this lot sworn in. And where's Sergeant Knock?
Pushed off, Sarge, said Wiglet. I don't know if it helps, but he said to hell with him when he went out the door.
Vimes counted heads. It'd be said, later on, that all the watch house stayed on. They hadn't, of course. Some had slipped away, some hadn't come back on duty at all. But it was true about Keel and the line.
Okay, lads, he said. It's like this. We know what's been going on. I don't know about you, but I don't like it. Once you get troops on the streets, it's only a matter of time before it goes bad. Some kid throws a stone, next minute there's houses on fire and people getting killed. What we're going to do is keep the peace. That's our job. We're not going to be heroes. We're just going to be normal. Now, he shifted position, it might just be that someone will say we're doing something wrong, so I'm not going to order you.
He drew his sword and scratched a line across the mud and stones.
If you step over the line, then you're in, he said. If you don't, then that's fine. You didn't sign up for this, and I doubt there'll be any medals, whatever happens. I'll just ask you to go, and the best of luck to you.
It was almost depressing how quickly Lance Constable Vimes crossed the line. Fred Colon came next, and Waddy, and Billy Wiglet, and Spatchcock, Culweather, and Moist, and Leggy Gaskin, and Horace Nancy Ball, and Curry, wasn't it, and Evans, and Pounce. A dozen crossed the line, the last few with the reluctance caused by a battle between peer pressure and a healthy regard for their skin. A few others, more than Vimes had hoped, evaporated at the back. That left Ned Coates. He crossed his arms.
You're all bloody mad, he said.
We could use you, Ned, said Vimes.
I don't want to die, said Ned, and I don't intend to. This is stupid. There's not a dozen of you. What can you do? All that stuff about keeping the peace, it's rubbish, lads. Coppers do what they're told by the men in charge. It's always like that. What'll you do when the new captain comes in, eh? And who are you doing this for? The people? They attack the other houses, and what's the night watch ever done to hurt them?
Nothing, said Vimes.
There you are, then.
I mean, the watch did nothing, and that's what hurt them, said Vimes.
What could you do, then? Arrest Winder?
Vimes felt he was building a bridge of matchsticks over a yawning abyss, and now he could feel the chilly winds below him. He'd arrested Vetinari back in the future. Admittedly, the man had walked free after what passed for the due process of law, but the city watch had been, was going to be, big enough and strong enough and well-connected enough to actually arrest the ruler of the city. How had they ever got to that stage? How had he even dreamed that a bunch of coppers could slam the cell door on the boss? Well, perhaps it had started here. Lance Constable Vimes was watching him intently.
"Of course we can't," he said. "But we ought to be able to. Maybe one day we will. If we can't, then the law isn't the law. It's just a way of keeping people down."
"Looks like you've woken up and smelled the khaki," said Coates, "because that's exactly what you're in. Sorry, lads, but you're going to die. That's what'll happen if you tangle with real soldiers. Remember Dolly Sisters last night? 3 dead and they weren't even trying."
"Come on, Ned. No one's going to have a go at us if we're just patrolling," mumbled Colon.
"Patrolling for what?" said Coates. "To keep the peace? What'll you do when there's no peace left to keep? Well, I'm not going to stand around and see you get killed. I'm off."
He turned and strode out of the yard and into the watch house. "You bloody fool, you're right," Vimes thought. "I just wish you weren't so right."
"Still with us, lads," he said to the group caught behind the line.
"That's right, Sarge," said Lance Constable Vimes.
The rest of the volunteers seemed slightly less certain.
"Are we going to get killed?" said Wiglet. "Who says it's going to come to a fight?" said Vimes, watching Coates' retreating back. "Wait a moment, I want a word with Ned."
"Got the sinning, Sarge,"
Snouty announced, advancing across the yard,
"and the captain wants a word with you."
"Tell him I'll be up there in just a few."
"It's a new captain," said Snouty quickly. "He's there already. Keen, military. Not the patient type, Sarge."
"I used to have carrot and detritus and anger and cheery for this," Vimes thought bitterly. "I'd say you do this and you do that, and all I had to do was fret and deal with the sodding politics."
"Get Fred to swear the men in," he said, "and tell the officer I'll be with him shortly."
He ran through the watch house and out the front door. There were a lot of people in the street, more than usual. It wasn't a mob as such, but it was Ankh Morpork's famous mob. The state you got just before a real mob happened.
It spread across the city like web and spider, and when some triggering event happened, twanged its urgent message through the streets and thickened and tightened around the spot. The Dolly Sisters massacre had got around, and the numbers had grown in the telling. Vimes could sense the tension on the web. It was just waiting for some idiot to do the wrong thing, and nature is bountiful where idiots are concerned. "Coates!" he yelled. To his surprise, the man stopped and turned.
"Yeah? I know you're with the revolutionaries.
You're just guessing."
"No.
You had the password in your notebook," said Vimes. "The same one Dibbler was passing out in pies. You must know I was able to get into the lockers. Look, do you think you and Dibbler would still be walking around if I was a spy for Swing?"
"Sure. You're not after us. We can be mopped up later. Swing wants the leaders."
Vimes stood back.
"Okay. Why haven't you told the lads?"
"Things are moving, that's why.
It's all starting," said Ned. "Who you are doesn't matter any more, but you're going to get all the lads killed. They'd have been on our side if it wasn't for you. I was working on them. You know Spatchcock always drops his sword on his foot, and Nancy Bull wets himself when he's threatened, and Vimesy is simple, and now you're going to stick them all in the middle, and they're going to die, and all for no reason."
"Why haven't you told them?" Vimes repeated.
"Maybe you got friends in high places," Ned snarled.
Vimes glanced up at the rooftops.
"Have we finished?" said Ned.
"Give me a badge," said Vimes.
"You what?"
"You're quitting, fair enough. Give me a badge."
Coates recoiled as if he'd been stung.
"Blow that."
"Then leave the city," said Vimes. "It'd be for your own good."
"Is that a threat?"
"Not from me. But here's some advice, boy. Don't put your trust in revolutions. They always come round again. That's why they're called revolutions. People die and nothing changes. I'll see you later."
He turned his back and hurried away so that the man wouldn't see his face.
Okay. Now it was time. It had to be now, or he'd burst like Mr. Salsiferous. He had wanted to do this, hadn't dared try it, because those monks could probably do a man a lot of no good if he crossed them. But it had all gone too far now. A sense of duty told him there was an officer waiting to see him. He overruled it. It was not in possession of all the facts. Vimes reached the entrance to the watch house and stopped. He shut his eyes. If anyone bothered to look at him, they'd have seen a man apparently trying to grind two cigarette stubs into the road, one with each foot. "Thank you, Rosie, for those cardboard soles," he smiled. He thought with the brains in his feet. And as young Sam had noticed, the feet had a memory of their own. Rounded, cat-head cobbles, the usual kind, they hadn't been well set in this part of the city and moved very slightly underfoot. Then, twice before getting to the watch-house, his feet had felt larger cobbles, narrow bands of them where the road surface had been replaced after drains had been laid. And before that, there'd been a similar band, but of soft brick rubble, so crushed by cartwheels that it was practically a gully. A few dozen steps earlier, they'd twirled him round a couple of times, but the last surface before that had been mud. Vimes, who'd been walking with his eyes shut, bumped into a cart. Mud, he thought, getting up and ignoring the strange looks of passers-by. That meant an alley. Let's see. Yes, over there. It took 20 minutes. People turned as he walked through the streets, closing his eyes when he dared, so that his feet could see better. Sometimes he did look around, though, and there it was again, the thunderstorm sensation of tensions building up, waiting for the first little thing. People were uneasy. The herd was restless, and he didn't know quite why. Everyone he looked at returned his gaze blankly. He stepped onwards. Rough flagstones between two stretches of the ancient cobbles they called troll heads. The only place where you got that in this part of the city was here, where Pewter Street crossed Elm, and before that it had been, big stones, some of the most ancient in the city, rutted by hundreds and hundreds of years of iron-bound cartwheels. That was a road that had been right behind a city wall. Yes, he crossed the pits, still on Elm, and then lost his thread. A metal grating on the pavement gave it back to him. Cellar grating, cool cellar. Coat of arms and it worn down. Buttermarket. Yep, go feet. The monks had turned him again here, but long bricks, hard-fired in the kiln, and a stretch of quite modern flagstones, well-dressed and fitted. It could trick you if you didn't know you were in, Mason's Road, and there were masons here, and they looked after the surface. Now find an alley, mud, but with a lot of gravel in it, because the stonemasons dumped their waste here, but this one has occasional hummocks across it, where pipes have been laid. Now find square-head cobbles. He opened his eyes. Away on his left was a block of three buildings, a temple, sandwiched between two cheap jack corner shops. It was just a temple, slightly foreign-looking, but weren't they all? It looked high Hublandish, where everyone lived on yaks or something. The temple doors were locked. He rattled the handle impotently, then hammered on the woodwork with his sword.
It had no effect. He didn't even leave a mark on the wood. But the door of the shonky shop next door was open. It was a familiar place. Once upon a time it was his tailor and bootmaker. And, like a pawn shop, a shonky shop was always open. Vimes stepped inside and was immediately enveloped in dusty darkness. It was a cave of cloth. Racks of old suits hung from the ceiling, ancient shelves bent under piles of shirts and vests and socks. Here and there, old boxes loomed in the gloom and caught his knees. Piles of derelict boots slipped and slid under his feet. And there was the smell. If poverty had a smell, this was it. If humbled pride had a smell, this was it. And there was a touch of disinfectant as well. Within a few feet of the door, Vimes was already lost. He turned and shoved his way through grey aisle after grey aisle of suffocating cloth and wondered if anyone had ever died in here and how anyone could ever find their way out. He pulled aside a hanger containing a greasy, threadbare suit. "Do you want?" He turned. There was no one there, until his gaze fell slightly and met that of a small, glossy little man, totally bald, very small, and thin, and wearing some vague clothing that presumably even a shonky shop hadn't been able to unload on a customer. Who was he? Who was he? Surprisingly, the name seemed quite fresh in the memory.
Mr. Shine? Soon Shine Sun, said Mr. Soon.
He grabbed the suit Vimes was still holding.
Good eye, good eye. Lovely cloth, lovely cloth. Owned by priest, very good. 50 pence to you. Shame to sell it. Times are hard.
Vimes hastily put the suit back on the rack and pulled out his badge. Soon glared at it.
I pay already other copper, he said. $1, 1 month, no trouble. Already I pay other copper.
Pay, said Vimes.
2 stripe copper, already I pay. $1, 1 month, no trouble.
Corporal Quirk, muttered Vimes.
You don't have to pay coppers, Mr. Soon. We're here for your protection.
Despite his barely basic grasp of the language, Mr. Soon's expression suggested very clearly that the 3-stripe, 1-crown copper in front of him had dropped in from the planet Idiot.
Look, I haven't got time for this, said Vimes. Where's the back door? This is watch business. I pay protection. 1 month, no trouble.
Vimes grunted and set off along another narrow, cloth-lined tunnel. A glint of glass caught his eye, and he sidled crabwise up a choked aisle until he found a counter. It was piled with more hopeless merchandise, but there was a bead-curtained doorway behind it. He half-clambered, half-swam over the piles and scrambled into the tiny room beyond. Mr. Soon pushed his way to an ancient tailor's dummy. It was so scratched, chipped and battered, it looked like something dug up from the volcanic ash of an ancient city. He pulled on an arm, and the eyes lit up.
Number 3, here, he said into its ear. He's just gone through, and boy, is he angry.
The back door was locked, but yielded under the weight of Vimes's body. He staggered into the yard, looked up at the wall separating this greasy space from the temple's garden, jumped, scrabbled his boots on the brickwork, and dragged himself onto the wall, feeling a couple of bricks crumble away underneath him. He landed on his back and looked up at a thin, robed figure sitting on a stone seat.
"Cup of tea, Commander?" said Sweeper, cheerfully. "I don't want any damned tea!" shouted Vimes, struggling to his feet.
Sweeper dropped a lump of rancid yak butter in the tea bowl beside him.
"What do you want, then, Mr. Vimes, with the very helpful feet? I can't deal with this, you know what I mean." "You know, some tea really would calm you down," said Sweeper. "Don't tell me to be calm. When are you going to get me home?"
A figure stepped out of the temple. He was taller, heavier man than Sweeper, white-haired and with the look of a good-natured bank manager about him. He held out a cup. Vimes hesitated a moment and then took the cup and poured the tea out on the ground.
"I don't trust you," he said. "There could be anything in this. I can't imagine what we could put in tea that would make it any worse than the way you normally drink it," said Sweeper calmly. "Sit down, Your Grace, please."
Vimes sagged onto the seat. The rage that had been driving him sank a little too, but he could feel it bubbling. Automatically, he pulled out a half-smoked cigar and put it in his mouth.
"Sweeper said you'd find us one way or another," said the other monk. "So much for secrecy."
"Why should you worry?" said Vimes. "You can just play around with time and it won't have happened, right?"
"We don't intend to do that," said the other monk.
"What could I do anyway? Go around telling everyone that those loony monks you see in the streets are some kind of time shifters? I'd get locked up. Who are you, anyway?"
"This is Q," said Sweeper, nodding at the other monk. When the time comes, he'll get you back, but not yet.
Vimes sighed. The anger had drained, leaving only a hopeless, leaden feeling. He stared blankly at the strange rockery that occupied most of the garden. It looked oddly familiar. He blinked.
I've been talking to people today who are going to die, he said. How do you think that makes me feel? Do you know what that feels like?
The monks gave him a puzzled look.
Yes, said Q.
We do, said Sweeper. Everyone we talk to is going to die. Everyone you talk to is going to die. Everyone dies.
I've been changing things, said Vimes, and added defensively,
Well, why shouldn't I? Carceries? I have no idea how things are going to turn out. I mean, doesn't it change history even if you just tread on an ant?
For the ant, certainly, said Q.
Sweeper waved a hand.
I told you, Mr. Vimes, history finds a way. It's like a shipwreck. You're swimming to the shore. The waves will break whatever you do. Is it not written, the big sea does not care which way the little fishes swim? People die in their due time. Keel didn't. Carcer mugged the poor devil.
His due time in this prison, Commander, said Q. But he will pay his part in the other, Mr. Vimes, eventually. You'll reach the shore. You must, otherwise.
There's no shore, said Sweeper.
No, said Vimes. There's got to be more. I'm not swimming, I'm drowning.
It was fun, do you know, at first, like a boy's night out, feeling the street under me boots again. But now, what about Sybil? Are my memories real? What I know is she's a girl living with her dad. Is there somewhere where she's my wife having my child? I mean, really? Is it all in my mind? Can you prove it? Is it happening? Will it happen? What is real?
The monks were silent. Sweeper glanced at Q, who shrugged. He glanced rather more meaningfully, and this time Q made that dismissive little wave of the hand which is someone signifying all right against my better judgment. Then Sweeper said,
Yes, very slowly. Yes, I think we can help, Commander. You want to know there's a future waiting. You want to hold it in your hand. You want to feel the weight of it. You want one point to navigate by, one point to steer for. Yes, I think we can help you there, but...
Yes.
But you must climb back over that wall, and Sergeant Keel plays his part. He sees it all through to the end. He gives the orders he feels are right, and they will be the right orders. He holds the line. He does the job.
He's not the only one, said Vimes.
Yes, Commander Vimes has a job in hand too.
Don't worry. I'm not leaving Carcer behind, growled Vimes.
Good. We'll be in touch.
Vimes tossed the stump of his cigar aside and looked up at the wall.
All right, he said. I'll see it through. But when the time comes, we will be ready, said Sweeper. Just so long as you...
He stopped. There was another subtle sound, scaly in its way, a sort of silicon slither.
My goodness, said Q.
Vimes looked down. The cigar butt still smouldered, but around it, the garden of inner-city tranquility was moving, pebble sliding over tiny pebble. A large, water-rounded rock floated gently around, spinning. And then Vimes became aware that the whole garden was spinning, turning on the little wisp of smoke. A spent match sailed past, rolling from stone to stone like a scrap of food passed from ant to ant.
Is it meant to do that? He said. In theory, yes, said Sweeper. I should leave right now, Mr. Vimes.
Vimes took one last look at the moving garden, shrugged, and then heaved himself over the wall. The two monks stared. The tide of little stones was gently pushing the stub into the centre.
Astonishing, said Q. He's part of the pattern now. I don't know how you manage it.
I'm not doing it, said Sweeper. Q, can we...
No more time-shifting, said Q. It's caused quite enough trouble.
Fair enough, said Sweeper. Then I'll need to send out search parties. The fences, the bent jewellers, the pawn shops. We'll find it. I understand our friend. The job's not enough. He needs one real thing, and I know what it is.
They looked again at the turning, shifting garden, and felt the fingers of history spreading out and into the world. Vimes tried not to run back to the watch house because too many people were standing around in groups, and even a running uniform could be risky. Besides, you didn't run for officers. He was a sergeant. Sergeants walked with a measured tread. To his mild surprise, the men were still out in the yard. Someone had even hung up the swordsmanship targets, which would certainly be helpful if the watchmen were faced with an enemy who was armless and tied to a pole. He climbed the stairs. The captain's door was open, and he saw that the new man had repositioned his desk so that he could see out onto the landing and down the stairs. Not a good sign, not a good sign at all. An officer shouldn't see what was going on. He should rely on his sergeants to tell him what was going on. That way, things ran smoothly. This man was keen. Oh, dear. The new captain looked up. Oh, good grief, Vimes thought. It's bloody Rust this time round. And it was indeed the Honourable Ronald Rust, the God's gift to the enemy, any enemy, and a walking encouragement to desertion. The Rust family had produced great soldiers by the undemanding standards of deduct your own casualty from those of the enemy, and if the answer is a positive sum, it was a glorious victory, school of applied warfare. But Rust's lack of any kind of military grasp was matched only by his high opinion of the talent that he in fact possessed only in negative amounts. It hadn't been Rust last time. He vaguely remembered some other dim captain. All these little changes, what would they add up to? I bet he's only just been made a captain, thought Vimes. Just think of the lives I could save by accidentally cutting his head off now. Look at those blue eyes. Look at that stupid curly moustache. And he's only going to get worse.
Are you Kill?
The voice was a bark.
Yes, sir. I sent an order for you to come up here an hour ago, man.
Yes, sir. But I've been on duty all night and morning, and it's been rather a lot to attend to.
I expect an order to be obeyed promptly, Sergeant.
Yes, sir, so do I. That's why discipline starts at the top, Sergeant. The men obey you, you obey me, I obey my superiors.
Glad to hear it, sir.
Rust had the same firm grip of common politeness, too.
What is all that going on in the yard?
Vimes steered according to the prevailing wind.
Bit of morale building, sir. Instilling a bit of esprit de corps.
And hit a reef. Rust raised his eyebrows.
Why? He said. The men's job is to do what they're told, as is yours. A group hug is not part of the arrangements, is it?
A bit of camaraderie helps the job along, sir, in my experience.
Are you eyeballing me, Keel?
No, sir. I am wearing an expression of honest doubt, sir. Eyeballing is four steps up, right after looking at you in a funny way, sir. By standard military custom and practice, sir, sergeants are allowed to go all the way up to an expression of acute...
What's that pip over your stripes, man?
Means sergeant-at-arms, sir. They were a special kind of copper.
The captain grunted and glanced at the papers in front of him.
Lord Winder has received an extraordinary request that you be promoted to lieutenant, sergeant. It has come from Captain Swing of the Particulars, and his lordship listens to Captain Swing. Oh! And he wants you to be transferred to the particulars. Personally, I think the man's mad.
I'm 100% behind you there, sir.
You do not wish to be a lieutenant?
No, sir.
Too long for Dick and too short for Richard, sir,
said Vimes, focusing on a point a few inches above Rust's head.
What?
Neither one thing nor the other, sir.
Oh, so you'd like to be a captain, eh?
Said Rust, grinning evilly.
No, sir. Don't want to be an officer, sir. Get confused when I see more than one knife and fork on a table, sir.
You certainly don't look like officer material to me, Sergeant.
No, sir. Thank you, sir.
Good old Rust. Good young Rust. The same unthinking rudeness masquerading as blunt speaking, the same stiff-neckedness, the same petty malice. Any sergeant worth his salt would see how to make use of that.
Wouldn't mind transferring to the particulars, though, sir,
he volunteered. It was a bit of a gamble, but not much. Rust's mind was reliable.
I expect you would like that, Keel, said Rust. No doubt you ran rings round that old fool Tilden, and don't fancy the idea of a captain with his finger on a pulse, eh? No, you can damn well stay here, understand?
Wonderful, thought Vimes. Sometimes it's like watching a wasp land on a stinging nettle. Someone's going to get stung, and you don't care.
Yes, sir,
he said, eyes still staring straight ahead.
Have you shaved today, man?
Excused shaving, sir, Vimes lied. Doctor's orders. Been sewn up on a face, sir. Could shave one off, sir.
He remained at eye front, while Rust grudgingly stared at him. The cut was still pretty livid,
and Vimes hadn't dared look under the patch yet.
"Hit yourself in the face with your own bell, did you?"
grunted the captain. Vimes' fingers twitched. "Very funny, sir," he said.
"Now, go and get the men fell in, Keel. Look sharp, I shall inspect them in a moment. And tell that idiot with the flat nose to clear the stable."
"Sir?"
"My horse will be arriving shortly. I don't want to see that disgusting screw in there."
"What?"
"Turn out Marilyn, sir," said Vimes, genuinely shocked. "That was an order. Tell him to jump to it."
"What do you want us to do with her, sir?"
"I don't care. You're a sergeant, you've had an order. Presumably there are knacker men. People round here must eat something, no doubt."
Vimes hesitated a moment. Then he saluted.
"Right you are, sir," he said. "Do you know what I saw on the way here, sergeant?"
"Couldn't say, sir," said Vimes, staring straight ahead.
"People were building barricades, sergeant."
"Sir?"
"I know you heard me, man."
"Well, it's to be expected, sir. It's happened before. People get jumpy. They hear rumours of mobs and out-of-control soldiers. They try to protect their street.
It is a flagrant challenge to government authority. People can't take the law into their own hands."
"Well, yes, but these things generally run their course.
My gods, man, how did you manage to get promoted?"
Vimes knew he should leave it at that. Rust was a fool, but at the moment he was a young fool, which is more easily excused. Maybe it was just possible, if caught early enough, that he could be upgraded to idiot.
"Sometimes it pays to..." he began. "Last night, every watch house in the city was mobbed," said Rust, ignoring him. "Except this one. How do you account for that?"
His moustache bristled. Not being attacked was definite proof of Vimes's lack of moral fibre.
It was just a case of, apparently, a man attempted an assault on you. Where is he now?"
"I don't know, sir. We bandaged him up and took him home."
"You let him go?"
"Yes, sir, he was..." But Rust was always a man to interrupt an answer with a demand for the answer he was in fact interrupting.
"Why?" "Sir, because at that time I thought it prudent to..." "Three watchmen were killed last night, did you know that? There were gangs roaming the streets. Well, martial law has been declared. Today we're going to show them a firm hand. Get your men together now."
Vimes saluted, turned about, and walked slowly down the stairs. He wouldn't have run for a big clock. A firm hand, right. Gangs roaming the streets. Well, we sure as hell never did anything when they were criminal gangs. And when you've got madmen and idiots on either side and everything hangs in the balance, well, trouble is always easy to find when you have enough people looking for it. One of the hardest lessons of young Sam's life had been finding out that the people in charge weren't in charge. It had been finding out that governments were not, on the whole, staffed by people who had a grip, and that plans were what people made instead of thinking. Most of the watchmen were clustered around the stairs. Snouty was quite good at internal communications of the worrying kind.
"Tidy yourselves, lads," said Vimes. "Captain will be down in a few minutes. Apparently it's time for a show of strength."
"What strength?" said Billy Wiglet.
"Ah, Billy, what happens is, the vicious revolutionaries take one look at us and scuttle off back to their holes," said Vimes.
He was immediately sorry he'd said that. Billy hadn't learned irony.
"I mean, we just give the uniforms an airing," he translated.
"We'll get cheesed," said Fred Colon.
"Not if we stick together," said Sam.
"Right," said Vimes. "After all, we're heavily armed men going on patrol amongst civilians who are, by law, unarmed. If we're careful, we shouldn't get too badly hurt." Another bad move. Dark sarcasm ought to be taught in schools, he thought. Besides, armed men could get into trouble if the unarmed civilians were angry enough, especially if there were cobblestones on the streets. He heard the distant clock strike three. Tonight, the streets would explode. According to the history books, it would be one shot that did it around sunset. One of the foot regiments would be assembled in Hen and Chicken's Field awaiting orders, and there would be people watching them. Troops always drew an audience. Impressionable kids, the inevitable Ankh-Morpork floating street crowd, and of course the ladies whose affection was extremely negotiable. The crowd shouldn't have been there, people said afterwards. But where should they have been? The field was a popular spot. It was the only vaguely green space in that part of the city. People played games there, and of course there was always the progress of the corpse on the gibbet to inspect. Besides, there were troops, ordinary foot soldiers, people's sons and husbands, taking a bit of a rest and having a drink. Oh, that was right. Afterwards it was said that the troops were drunk, and that they shouldn't have been there. Yep, that was the reason, Vimes reflected. No one should have been there. But they were,
and when that captain got an arrow in his stomach and was groaning on the ground, some of the crossbowmen fired in the direction of the shot. That's what the history book said. They fired at the house windows where people had been watching. Perhaps the shot had come from one of them. Some arrows fell short, some did not, and there were people who fired back. And then, one after another, horrible things would happen. By then it was too late for them not to. The tension would unwind like a spring, scything through the city. There were plotters. There was no doubt about that. Some had been ordinary people who'd had enough. Some were young people with no money who'd objected to the fact that the world was run by old people who were rich. Some were in it to get girls, and some had been idiots as mad as swing, with a view of the world just as rigid and unreal, who were on the side of what they called the people. Vimes had spent his life on the streets, and had met decent men and fools and people who'd steal a penny from a blind beggar, and people who'd performed silent miracles or desperate crimes every day behind the grubby windows of little houses, but he'd never met the people. People on the side of the people always ended up disappointed in any case. They found that the people tended not to be grateful or appreciative or forward-thinking or obedient. The people tended to be small-minded and conservative and not very clever, and were even distrustful of cleverness. And so the children of the revolution were faced with the age-old problem. It wasn't that you had the wrong kind of government, which was obvious, but that you had the wrong kind of people.